Welcome back, everyone. You're listening to episode 5 of Boston Strongcast. Today, we have a solo episode with our host and director of strength and conditioning here at Total Performance Sports, Kevin Kann. Kevin is going to be talking about the scientific principles of strength training with examples from his Chico training programs. This is a pretty long episode. Kevin, I think, could talk about this for days if he wanted to. So this is going to be about 50 minutes long. So I hope you're sitting down, and I hope that you have some time to kill. So here we go.
Hi, this is Kevin Kann with episode number 5 of Boston Strongcast. Today we're going to discuss the scientific principles of strength training. I'm going to kind of tie in my experiences that I've had working with Boris Chico for the better part of a little bit over 2 years. And I'm going to explain how his program ties in with these principles too, so you guys can kind of get an idea of that. Dr. Mike Isretel, Dr. James Hoffman, and Chad Wesley Smith have a book out there. It's called The Scientific Principles of Strength Training. I'm going to try to follow a similar format that they follow in that book. It's a really good read, and I think some consistency in the field can kind of help us piggyback off of each other and spread the word of good training advice. With this, though, I have kind of combined a couple of them. I've added a principle in there from something that I've picked up from Boris over the course of time. But let's get right into it. So the first principle we're going to discuss, and these are in order of importance, is going to be specificity. So again, this is the most important principle. So what we train needs to be specific to the task that we are trying to compete in. So for powerlifting, a max effort low bar squat, a max effort bench press, and a max effort deadlift are as specific as it gets. And there's an actual principle, it's called the SAID principle, S-A-I-D, stands for specific adaptation to imposed demand. So the body will adapt to handle whichever stressor that it encounters, but it'll adapt to handle that specific stressor. So I can't run marathons or do a bunch of hill sprints and expect my total to increase. Now this also goes for, I can't just train my legs in different manners and expect my one rep max squat to go up. So I can't just do a bunch of walking lunges and leg presses and expect my squat numbers to increase. So there is nothing more specific to the sport of powerlifting than taking max singles, again, in the squat, the bench press, and the deadlift. However, it would be nearly impossible to perform these max singles every time we entered the gym. That would just be too physically demanding, as well as psychological burnout would happen shortly after. So anytime we're working at weights over 90%, we run the risk of increasing injury risk as well as psychological burnout. So what we need to do is we need to build the muscles, the systems, and the neuromuscular coordination to be able to handle those max weights on the platform. With Boris Chico, so I perform all of my squats low bar. I pause every bench repetition as if it were a competition pause, and I perform my competition deadlift at all times. So I know a lot of programs out there will call for front squats and high bar squats. I've never completed one front squat or one high bar squat in the 107 weeks I've been under the bar with Boris Chico as my coach. Every lift we do, that bar is on the position in my back in which I'm going to compete. So for every pause variation that we do with chains, no matter what, that bar is in the competition position on my bench. Now there are times where I might have a longer pause on the bench press, but other than that, I comp pause every single rep, so I don't ever perform touch and go bench press. I have occasionally performed close grip bench press, but my grip is 81 centimeters, so wide grip bench press is out of the question. And for my deadlift, I never do opposite stance deadlift, so I pull conventional. So I train to pull conventional all of the time. And this is so that we can build the proper neuromuscular coordination within the competition lifts itself. It's that specific adaptation that we're looking for. Every little variation that we put on the bar moves it further away from our competition lift. And eventually, you lose enough of that specificity and you're not training the same motor pattern. So for example, if I use a safety squat bar and I squat to a box with chains, I've added so much variability to the lift itself that there's not going to be as much carryover to developing the proper neuromuscular coordination within the competition lift itself. Since I have a different bar, the weight's positioned differently on my back, I'm sitting back differently than I will in my competition lift and sitting back on a box, and then the accommodating resistance. So when we do vary our lifts, we want to keep specificity in mind. So typically what Shika will do a variation is I'll still have a low bar squat and it just might be one real subtle variation added to the lift. So it could be tempo in the squats. It may be chains, but there's not going to be a lot of chains, because if our accommodating resistance becomes too high and the bar weight becomes too low, we've now changed the speed of the lift to be much different than what it's going to be on the platform, and the strength curve just becomes it's not very similar to what we're going to see underneath max weights on the platform. So there are programs out there that get too far away from specificity and just vary lifts for the sake of varying lifts. Now there is the other end of the spectrum too. So there are a lot of programs out there that are specific and they attempt to be as specific as possible, but at the same time they can be too specific. So if we're only training the competition lifts and we're just varying, say, reps and sets, and we're not varying the actual lift itself in any way, shape, or form, one, it just gets boring and it can cause like a mental stalemate for the lifter. And then on top of that, if we have a weak portion within the lift, so let's say you have, this is a common fault in the squat, where coming up from the bottom position of the squat, you see the chest cave forward and the hips shoot backwards. We'll call this a good morning squat. So in a lot of cases, this means that the lifter has weak quads. So if our quads are weak within in the lift and we're only varying repetitions, our quads will continue to remain weak within that lift. Now, we do need to develop the quads in a specific manner to the actual squat. So if I am just trying to strengthen my quads with leg extensions and leg press, and I'm not trying to incorporate that into the lift, it's also not going to work. It needs to be specific. So with Shiko, this is why the variations that we do tend to work these muscle groups within these actual lifts themselves. So if there are weak quads on a lifter, what we might see is we might see some pause squats. We might see some pin squats. We're going to use repetitions and weights where we're not seeing that good morning squat occur, and we're going to hopefully be able to improve that from block to block. So hopefully, as the lifter develops appropriate neuromuscular coordination, we're seeing improvement in that position as the weights get heavier and the reps get more and more. But it needs to be specific to the actual lift itself in order for it to carry over for that development of the neuromuscular coordination. We do need to handle heavyweights on the platform, so we can't forget about that aspect of training. But we need to find a way to do that without always putting 90% or more on the bar, because like we mentioned earlier, this can be psychologically daunting and at the same time becomes a little risky physically. So we can actually use lighter weights and make them heavier. And this is something we'll kind of discuss more in the next principle, which is the overload principle. So this is the second most important principle in our training concepts. So basically what this says is that we must do a little more over time in order to progress. So the more can be in terms of volume or intensity. So we can do more lifts within a training block, and this can be done daily, weekly, monthly, and even moving out into further, such as yearly. Or we can increase the intensity. So each lifter is going to have a baseline of volume that's generally going to be calculated as sets times reps times weight. This is the easiest way to do it. I actually, within my sheets for my lifters, and Shiko does this with me, I track the number of lifts. So for squats on a daily, weekly, and monthly basis, and then it does carry out further as we carry it along. With this volume, there's going to be a minimum effective dose of volume that'll lead to minimum results. And there is also a maximum effective dose of volume for each lifter, where if we exceed this, the lifter will be unable to recover to continue to train at a high level. So this is generally what we talk about when we talk about overtraining. Now, I think we put too much behind overtraining, thinking that it's a bad thing. So basically, when we train volume, we build up fatigue. The more fatigue that you build up, the longer it's going to take to dissipate it in order to realize the strength that you've gained during that training block. So if we build up so much volume that we build up all of this fatigue and we're supposed to compete in a week, there's nothing you can do at that point. You're just not going to be able to put your best total on the platform because it's going to take longer for that fatigue to dissipate. So one of the principles, and we'll talk about it later on, is kind of controlling that fatigue fitness relationship over time so that we can put forth our best lifts during important competitions. So when trying to find a baseline for a lifter, this can be pretty difficult because, you know, there are some individual variants, which we will also discuss later. But typically what we do is we use the Russian strength classification chart. So this is a chart that's broken up by men and women, by weight class, and also by total. So there are class 3 lifters, class 2 lifters, class 1 lifters, and then we get up into the more competitive categories. So a candidate for Master of Sports, this is somebody who's competing at the national level. A Master of Sports, somebody who may be winning at the national level. And then we have a Master of Sport in international competition, which is somebody who's competing on the world stage. So the good thing about this chart, for one, is overload's kind of built into it. So when you start off as a class 3 lifter, your volume is going to be lower than it would be as a class 1 and 2 lifter. And then again, as you become a candidate for Master of Sport, your volume increases. And then it becomes very individualized as we get up into the more competitive categories, such as Master of Sport and Master of Sport in international competition. There does get to a point where the lifter has been lifting for so long and they've almost reached their complete potential within the sport that it almost becomes impossible for them to hit overload. So for example, somebody like Milanichev is probably not going to be able to do enough volume in the gym to stress overload. So his training becomes very specific and you'll start to see higher intensities. So once we determine where the lifter lies within this classification chart, I also take into account their training age and what they've done in previous blocks. So some of these programs do call for higher volume. So if somebody hasn't been training for a long period of time, it just wouldn't be smart for me to take them and immediately put them into 800 competition lifts in a given month when maybe they've only been doing 400 lifts in a given month. So typically the type of lifters that I have, they're class 1 and candidates for Master of Sports. So these are individuals that would be competitive. You know, they're winning local meets for the most part, and they're competing on the national stage. So the recommendation here would be 800 to 1,300 competition lifts in a given month. Now, there's a big gap there, and I'll explain some of the things that are going to pull down what each lifter is capable of lifting each month. But if they come from a program that has much lower volumes, it's going to be hard for them to jump into that recommended volume. So there has to be a ramping up process. If not, that's how we create overtraining injuries and psychological burnout, for one. So once we've determined their number of lifts and other factors that I take into consideration, like for example, one of my lifters has a physical job where he literally unloads luggage from airplanes. So this actually will take up some of the volume that he's capable of handling in a given month, we'll say. Let's look at everything on a monthly basis. So he's not going to lift. His volumes are going to be lower than another lifter who's in the same category and similar weight, who actually works as a coach. So his job's not as physically demanding, so he can handle a little bit more volume. I've also come to realize that other factors such as shift work. I do have one of my lifters who works overnight as a nurse. Her volume's much lower than my typical 9-to-5ers. And then on top of that, body weight is going to affect it. Some people just handle volume better than others. So there is kind of a feeling out process here. And as you start getting into the program, like, start them low, see how they respond, and then you can gradually build it up over time. And, you know, especially if you're further away from competition, there's no reason to really overdo it at this given time. Kind of feel out the lifter and make the appropriate adjustments as you go through. We track everything with RPEs, so we don't use RPEs a lot to dictate training. But I have a chart, and each lifter, I kind of, they do repeat certain things within a training block, and you can kind of see how accumulated fatigue will affect that. Like, for example, they might have 80% squats for 5 sets of 2 week one, and they might record these all as RPE 7s for all 5 top sets. And then maybe 2 weeks later, they have the exact same 5x2 at 80% on the squat again, and now all of a sudden everything's an 8 and 8.5. So you can start to see the fatigue accumulate over time and kind of know when you need to pull back the reins or when you can actually put the pedal down a little bit more. So we take all of that into consideration, and a lot of that stuff comes down to other principles too. All right, so we want to make sure our volume is the right amount to stress adaptation. It's not going to be so much that the lifter can't recover, and it's not going to be so little that it's only going to yield minimal gains. So typically what a week will look like, and there will be higher volume and lower volume weeks, and you'll kind of get a feel for each lifter as you go through the process, but there will be long blocks in time where we won't deload at all. We'll have each week, there'll be a day or two above baseline. So for example, if we have a lifter who's going to do, just for easy math, 1,000 lifts in a given month, we'll take those 1,000 lifts and we'll divide it by the number of training days in a month. So if this lifter trains 4 days per week, we divide the 1,000 lifts by 16, the number of training days in that month, and we get 62.5 lifts per day. This is our average volume day. So this is something that the lifter can perform and be able to recover before the next training day. So what we'll do from there is 1 to 2 of those days in that week will be around that number there. There'll be 1 or 2 days that'll be higher stress days. So for a lifter with 63 lifts, this will be anywhere from 70 to 80 lifts. And sometimes it does go over if I want a very high stress day in there for that lifter, which might happen once every 2 weeks. And then there'll be one day where there'll be 25 or less reps, say, for this lifter here. So it's typically their day 4, which is their second deadlift day, which will tend to use some type of deadlift variation that's not too taxing. It'll just be a bunch of general prep work after that. So it basically is in there for recovery. So ideally, they train Monday, Wednesday, Friday, Saturday, and then Sunday will be a recovery day. Completely off from the gym whatsoever. All right, so we're going to move on to our next scientific principle, which is going to be the principle of extrapolation. So what extrapolation is, this was translated from Chico's book, which is in Russian. And basically what this means is we want every repetition in training to look the exact same. So we're trying to build bulletproof neuromuscular coordination within each of the 3 lifts. So let's say we're doing 80% for 5 sets of 5 on the squat, and all 5 reps look different. We then have trained 5 different movement patterns. What we want is we want each rep to look the same so that we're creating a stable movement pattern. If not, the movement pattern is unstable, and underneath heavier weights, it's easy to break down because it's already broken down. The more stable the movement pattern is, the harder it is for it to break down underneath heavier weights. So this is something that I added in. So this is not in the Scientific Principles of Strength Training book. This is something that I've taken from working with Boris Chico for the last 2 years. So when we're determining how many lifts we're going to give the lifter, overload is still extremely important, right? So it's not like I can just give them one good lift each day in the gym and all of a sudden they're going to be winning world championships on the platform. We still need to hit a specific volume. However, most lifters, this is going to be what determines their top set intensities and their top set sets and rep schemes. So if they start to fall apart at 80% after two reps, it would be hard to put in 80% for sets of three. So the lifter needs to be able to develop the appropriate skill level with 80% for sets of two before we progress to sets of three. And I'm not going to give them 85% on a squat if 80% doesn't look up to par. So we'll continue to work on 80%, and then once that looks better, we'll start to progress it from there. So with the bench and the deadlift, it's a little bit different because we can actually do some things that allow the lifter to handle heavier weights without losing technique. So for example, on the bench press, if we use a board and a slingshot, we can keep technique the same and we can start handling weights above 90% of one rep max. And then for the deadlift, we can do things such as using blocks to lift heavier weights. And we can overload certain portions of the lifts with accommodating resistance. One other thing that we can do, because we do need to lift heavy, so we need to keep that part in mind, because that is our sport. And remember, we need to be specific to our sport. We can use lighter weights, but we can make it heavier by adding some type of variation to it. So if I do 70% from an 8 to 10 centimeter deficit for deadlifts, it's a lot heavier than 70%. If I pause 75% on the squat, it's a lot heavier than 75%. If I use a long pause on 75% on the bench press, it's heavier than 75%. So we're well within that range of weight to improve one rep max, but we can use lighter bar weight to make it seem heavier to the lifter. And this prevents psychological burnout as well, and helps develop proper neuromuscular coordination, because we never lose technique within a training block. So this is another thing that I think is very unique to a Chico program, is we very rarely go above 85% if we're not using boards or blocks, or on the squat it's rare. I take doubles at 85%. Occasionally on the squat, but that's about it. I very, very rarely ever take anything heavier. And the reason why is once we start getting heavier than 85%, we start seeing some of these things break down and we start seeing a sticking point. So if you go on the internet and you look a lot at sticking points, people will start to discuss weak muscle groups within the lift, but that's not necessarily true. It could just be that the lifter has poor neuromuscular coordination to handle the heavier weights. So neuromuscular coordination is just a fancy scientific word that makes me sound smarter to talk about technique. So if we're training with sticking points and with poor technique, we're just not building that proper neuromuscular coordination to be able to handle heavier weights. So if sticking points aren't due to weak muscles but poor neuromuscular coordination, we want, and I've discussed this a few minutes ago now, but say our quads are weak in the squat, the pin squats and pause squats, we want to strengthen those muscles within the lift itself because of the principle of extrapolation. So this is why, too, the volume in a Chico program becomes more geared towards the actual lifts and the slight variations on the lifts than it is to more local exercises such as accessory work, such as chest flies and tricep extensions and movements like that. The majority of the work is going to be within the competition lifts itself. And this is because of the principle of specificity. And if we're talking about the principle of overload, we want the majority of our overloading volume to be within these lifts itself, because it helps develop that proper neuromuscular coordination to handle heavier weights on the platform. And then we want to make sure that we're training each rep to be the exact same, so we abide by this principle of extrapolation, so that we're building a strong, stable movement pattern that's hard to break down. So if you are performing a program that the majority of the volume comes from accessory work and you're not seeing some type of progression, this is where it may be lacking. And you also want to make sure you're practicing the lifts frequent enough so that you can build that technique within the lift. So we tend to squat 2 days a week, we bench 3 to 4 days a week, and we deadlift 1 to 2 days a week. A lot of this depends on how many days per week each lifter trains. And it also depends on their recovery abilities, but the majority, if we're training 4 days a week, we're going to deadlift 2 days a week. And typically what you'll see is you'll see one of the days be more of a technique volume building day, and another day kind of be the competition lift with higher intensities, so to speak. But remember, we're not really going up over 85% in any of the competition lifts. And then the breakdown between the competition lifts. So because of the principle of specificity, you need to practice the lifts over and over and over again to get good at them. So we want to make sure there are enough competition lifts within our training block so that that occurs. So 20% of the overall volume are going to be the actual competition lifts themselves. The other 60% is going to be supplemental exercises. So these are the slight variations put on top of the competition lifts. And then the rest of it will be from developmental work, which is more focus on local muscle groups. It'll be lightweight, low speeds, which are there to kind of build tissue tolerance and aid in recovery. So 20%, the actual lifts, and that might be on that one day where you're going to hit higher intensities on the lift itself. It tends to have a little bit better of a carryover. And then the other day will be more technique work, which tend to be supplemental exercises that are chosen based upon the weaknesses within the lift of the lifter. So pin squats would be a supplemental exercise. A pause squat would be a supplemental exercise. If you're losing position off the floor in the deadlift, a pause 5 centimeters off the floor would be a supplemental exercise. And then the competition lifts would be done on the other days. One of the other things that Shiko uses a lot to abide by this principle of extrapolation, and this is kind of like I think the staple of a Shiko program, is you'll do the same lift twice in a given day. So for example, you might squat, then you'll go to bench press, then you'll squat again. So this allows the lifter to perform the same amount of volume. So we're abiding by the overload principle. We're abiding by the principle of specificity because we're practicing the lifts themselves. And then we abide by the principle of extrapolation, because splitting up the volume into two separate sessions on the same day, when you're taking a break to bench in between, like for the squat, it allows the lifter to stay fresh enough so that technique stays, so every rep stays the same. So for example, yesterday I actually did this. So I came into the gym, I did 85% for 4 sets of 2 on the squat. I then went to a bench press for 80%, 5 sets of 3. And then I came back to the squat at 80% for 4 sets of 2. So this allowed me to do 8 sets of 2 at an average intensity of 82.5%. That's for my top sets. Everything from 50% up is actually recorded and factored into average intensity. But my top sets, average intensity was at 82.5%. If I tried to do all 8 sets in a row of 2 reps, my technique is surely going to start to fade towards the end, and it's working against me. So instead of having like 16 quality reps at that average intensity, I may only have 8. So that's the principle of extrapolation. That's why we use double squat sessions. We have double deadlift sessions. And in a double deadlift session, what we might do is the first half of it might focus just off technique on the floor. So it might just be a deadlift to the knees. This lets the lifter slow down, focus on the technique there, and then we might deadlift off blocks to focus on the second half. And then day 4, we might do something that incorporates the entire range of motion together. So you're kind of working on the pieces and then putting it together. And this made a lot of sense to me, playing sports my entire life. You practice skills, and then you might scrimmage, and then you finally try to put it all together in a game. And that's kind of what I feel is happening here with the Shiko program. From the principle of extrapolation, we're going to move to our next principle. So in the book, I've mentioned a few times, this is kind of split up into a couple of different principles. However, I'm going to combine it and call it the principle of fitness versus fatigue. So what we're trying to do is, I guess as coaches, our primary job is we're stress managers. So we're trying to stress the lifter as much as possible to have them yield maximal gains, but not overstress them so much that they can't recover and dissipate that fatigue to put up their best numbers on the platform. So there becomes a real science to it with this, and it's almost like baking the perfect cake. As we train hard, we accumulate fatigue. Volume's going to accumulate more fatigue than intensity because we're doing more damage. So our energy substrates, the actual microtrauma to tissue, and our hormonal response is going to be much higher on volume days just because we're doing more work. So as we accumulate fatigue, typically what a lot of coaches will do, they'll add in deload weeks. And this is perfectly fine. So this will be a really light volume training week where intensity still needs to be maintained so that you don't lose any of the strength qualities that you've developed over time. But volume needs to drop substantially in this block, in this week-long period of time in the deload. And depending on the size of the lifter and the skill level of the lifter, this may need to occur every 3 to 7 weeks. And it usually follows a week of overreaching. So overreaching is where the lifter's volume will actually exceed what they can easily recover from. However, deloads are not the only way that we can do this. So I actually don't program what would be seen as an actual deload week based upon the terms I just laid out. So there may be lower volume weeks that are much easier on the lifter, and these might actually incorporate a lot of the same things that they've seen throughout the block. So the more that we actually see a certain rep scheme and a certain intensity or a certain variation, the more the lifter adapts to it and the less stressful it becomes. So if we've taken 80% for 5 sets of 2 week one, then we took 85%, we'll use like my day yesterday, we took 85% for 4 doubles and 80% for 4 doubles on the way back on week 2. Week 3, we took 80% for 5 triples. On week 4, if I give them 80% for 4 or 5 doubles, it's not going to be nearly as taxing as it was week 1. So on the lower volume weeks, I'll tend to incorporate a lot of sets and reps that mimic what they've been doing throughout the block, and this includes the variations. On top of that, I've kind of mentioned this a little bit before, there'll be 1 to 2 days in the week that exceed their volume baseline. There'll be 1 to 2 days that are right at their volume baseline, and then there'll be 1 day for recovery. So those days above baseline are the ones that are actually going to stress the lifter to adapt. The days at baseline kind of help maintain, and then the recovery days are just that. They allow them to recover. When we talk about recovery, there's ways that we can actually include the lifts and not beat up the lifter too much. So this is kind of where a science within this higher frequency training block comes in. So each lift itself has a different recovery curve. So the bench press is the easiest lift to recover from, and that's why we bench 3 to 4 times a week. The squat's more difficult to recover from the bench press, but it's easier than the deadlift. So that's why we squat 2 times a week. And the deadlift is the most difficult lift to recover from, and that's why we do that 1 to 2 times per week. And the second deadlift day is a low volume day that typically works on technique, or the lifter will lift from blocks, which make it much easier to recover. So also for recovery, if we use blocks, if we use a spoto press, if we use a slingshot, chains become a tool in recovery as well. So certain muscle groups, just because of the way that we are built, tend to take more of a beating. So your hamstrings and quads tend to get really sore, but I bet your medial delts don't ever get really, really sore. You just can't stretch them enough in order to cause enough damage. So for, you know, general work sometimes, for that developmental work, adding in medial delts can be far less taxing on a lifter than adding in more front delts if they've had a bench heavy week. The pecs also tend to get beat up pretty much if you're benching 3 to 4 times a week. So this is where the boards, the spoto press, and the slingshot come in. They take a lot of pressure off of the pecs and the front delts to allow the lifter to continue to lift and still recover from them. Blocks, like I mentioned a minute ago, make the deadlift a lot easier to recover from. Just deadlifting to the knees becomes easier to recover from than if we're moving it through its full range of motion and actually locking it out. So if we use chains on the squat also, I mentioned how this can be important for recovery. Slight variations allow certain motor units to actually recover while you're still lifting weights. So if I use squats with chains on a given day, certain motor units are going to be able to recover so I can come back the next squat day and really put the pedal down if I want to. I tend to use chains a lot after a meet because it still allows the lifter to feel weight on their back at the top, but we can use far less bar weight, which just gives them a psychological break from lifting heavy and also kind of allows them to recover while still using that little bit of weight. And I kind of like to call this bonus volume. So at this point, the chains, they're not added to my overall volume when I calculate it, which is why I use the term bonus volume. So as we move down into the next block, and also like with fitness and fatigue too, the taper becomes extremely important here. So I see a lot of programs that call for a lot of volume and a lot of intensity leading up to the week before the meet, which for some people, this can just be far too much to recover from. At that point, accumulating more fatigue to try to get stronger, I don't think is worth the risk of potentially getting injured or potentially accumulating so much fatigue that it's not going to dissipate till after the meet. So with Chico, the taper is pretty straightforward. We test 17 to 22 days out. So on day one, we'll test the squat and the bench. On day two, we'll bench, and then we'll test the deadlift, which will bring us about 17 days out. That training week will be about the same as any other. So it'll be 4 days that week. Training volume will be relatively close to what we're accustomed to. And then after that week, the volume starts to pretty dramatically drop off and the intensity gradually drops off. So the following week after the test, we'll only train 3 days. And in that week, that first day for squats, on Monday, we might take 80% for three singles. So this is far less volume than we're used to. And then the next squat day, you might see intensity drop to three singles at 75%. So you can kind of see the gradual decrease in intensity there. This has worked very well for my lifters, from everyone from a 52-kilogram female to 105-kilogram males. This taper tends to work extremely well. I just don't see a benefit into pushing training closer to the meet date. So the 52-kilogram lifter will test that 17 days out, and after that day two test, it'll be about a 10-day taper, where at the other end of the spectrum, it's a good 14-day taper. So there is a little bit of leeway there, but not much. And this will bring us to the next principle, which is the principle of variation. So this is not the most important thing, which is why some programs that don't have any variation are still successful, because they are abiding by the principle of specificity. There is overload there. And doing repetition work does help with technique, so they are even abiding by that principle. But remember, the more principles that we abide by, the more optimal the program is going to be. So with variation, what we're trying to do is give the lifter a problem to solve to better build their neuromuscular coordination or their technique. So if I give a lifter a pause on the halfway down squat, they need to kind of figure it out. So what this does is it slows down their start position. So a lot of times you'll see lifters, when they push their ass back to initiate the squat, the chest starts to cave forward. So position starts to get lost. So I can slow down that to have them really concentrate that. And then they can pick up speed after that pause and learn how to kind of accelerate through the hole and finish out that lift. It just gives them a problem to solve. Chains gives the lifter a problem to solve. Pauses give the lifter a problem to solve. And the more problems we give them to solve, the stronger that neuromuscular coordination becomes. In the beginning, when you give a lifter a pause on the halfway down in the squat, they can't find it. They don't really have any recognition of where they are within the lift in space. And then over time, as they start to practice and they start to develop better skill level within the lifts, they're able to kind of pause at the same spot every single time, and they're in much greater control. Chico does believe that load variability is one of the more important aspects of training. I put it further down the list just because you know, you can vary the load all you want, but if you lose specificity, you're not training towards the sport. The body's going to adapt towards something else. You can vary the load all you want, but if you're not hitting at least the minimum effective dose of volume, there's not going to be any progress made. And varying the load too much can take away from the principle of extrapolation when we're trying to build a stable, solid movement pattern. So variation I put here just for that reason. And I had mentioned this earlier, and there's a lot of overlap between all of the principles. So variation, it aids in recovery. So just varying the movement just a little bit allows certain motor units and stuff to recover so that the lifter can come back and crush it the next day. I can use lighter bar weight and make it more difficult on the lifter, you know, by pausing at 70%, but it's not going to do the same damage as if I put 75 or 80% on the bar. So it can allow the lifter to get more higher quality work performed without really breaking them down. What I really like, too, about a lot of the variations, Ed Cohen had said this, if you have a weak spot of the lift, spend more time there. So this is where we'll use like tempo and we'll use certain pauses in certain weak areas within the lift just to build up that neuromuscular coordination. And, you know, somebody with those lifts is the greatest of all time is probably somebody you should listen to. And, you know, with that said, the coach should be analyzing the lifter's lifts between the unrack, the walkout, the eccentric, the transition between the eccentric and the concentric, the lockout. And determine where the lifter needs work, and the variation should be put in there and have a purpose. So they should be to fix those technical errors within those areas of the lift itself. And you shouldn't just be varying stuff for the sake of varying it. And whatever variation you choose, it needs to stay in there long enough to actually have a training effect. If we just take each variation, we alternate it every single week, we're never going to know what works for one, and two, the lifter will never solve that problem because they don't see it enough in order to adapt. So you want to keep it in long enough where it has a good training effect and you can track its progress or whether it didn't work, and you don't want to vary it too much. Next principle. So we're getting towards the end here. This principle, I actually stole this term from the book because I like it. It's called phase potentiation. So basically what this is saying is that our training needs to be organized at a larger level. So there needs to be specific blocks that focus on specific aspects. So for example, you could do a hypertrophy block followed by an intensity block, then a taper, then a meet. As we get closer to competition, you need to see volume drop. There's going to be less variation, intensity is going to rise just slightly, and then we're going to hit that test and that taper. With that said, I don't like to just, and Chico doesn't do this with my programs either, if we're in a volume block, we don't just do sets of 10 or sets of 8, and we completely just forget about intensity. So within a volume block, there's going to be enough higher intense days that are going to be there to help maintain the strength qualities that we've developed using heavier weights during different blocks. So for example, I'm in a volume block now, and last week I performed some deficit deadlifts, and then I came back after bench to hit deadlifts for 4x2 at 80%. And other than that, I've been doing like 5x4s at 70% with chains. I've been doing more volume off blocks, a lot of double deadlift days, where my deadlift lifts in a week might be around 50 lifts in that given week, but there's still enough higher intensity days thrown in there that allow me to maintain my strength handling heavy weights. If I'm just working with, say, sets of 10, the bar weight's probably between, you know, 65, if you're lucky, 70%, and you're going to lose some qualities that you've developed underneath heavier weight. So there has to be enough of that. But the focus of those blocks is still on the volume and building up the work capacity or whatever else we're trying to build up with the volume, the muscle mass and all that stuff. So it still makes up the majority of the block. And in an intensity block or a peaking block or something like that, there's still going to be enough higher volume days that help maintain what I've built during the volume blocks. Now we're on to our last principle, which is the principle of individual differences. So for this principle here, This basically says that we are all our own unique little snowflakes. Now, this is the least important principle, but it is still important, and I've alluded to this a little bit earlier here, where, you know, I have lifters that have physical jobs. They do shift work. They work full-time and during grad school, and all of that stuff needs to apply. Women tend to be able to recover a lot easier than men and can handle higher volumes. But even with that said, like, some women just don't have a genetic predisposition to handle higher volumes. So even, you know, two women that are the same age, same weight class, with same total, there might be different volumes that they're capable of handling. You know, I mean, for that principle, that basically it is what it is. You can't change genetics. You can't really deal with it. If you're keeping a good training log, you're going to be able to track your progress and be able to figure it out from there. And that's why I said earlier, like, start on the lower end, see how everything goes, and then you can gradually build it. There's no rush to just jump into higher volumes, higher intensity stuff. Take your time. In order to put forth your best total in a career, it's going to take a long time regardless, and it's just not worth the risk. And to wrap things up, I'm just going to say what I kind of said in the beginning. Like, you can get stronger as long as some of these principles are minimally followed. But if you're competitive in this sport, the goal should be to gain maximal strength, not just minimal gains over time. Now, there is a risk-reward benefit here, because there you can get really strong really fast, but it can be risky training. Like, if you're training above 90% too often, there's probably a period where you're going to get hurt at a given time, you're going to go backwards, you're going to try to catch back up, and it's just going to be a continuous cycle. So you want to make sure you're training right below that line where that's going to happen. You know, if you are listening to this and you have a program, size up your program to see where it falls and how many principles it actually follows. If you're just following like a cookie cutter program, or a coach is writing a program for, you know, everybody online to do, or you're just doing the program that your buddies are doing, that's not necessarily what's optimal. So give it a look over and, you know, see how it stacks up. And if it doesn't stack up well, it's time to find a better coach. All right, we're getting over the mark where anybody even gives a shit at this point anymore. So we're going to wrap it up. See ya.